It's not about story. It's not about acting. It's not about performance. It's not about rolling weird dice. It's the opportunity to make decisions in a situation you may never actually get to experience yourself.
Howdy, friends. I got to sit down and talk with Anthony Boyd. He's better known as Runeslinger on YouTube. He's got hundreds of videos devoted to the philosophy and concepts and instructions around role-playing. We get pretty deep into kind of the history of role-playing, what role-playing is now, how it's changed over the years. My favorite parts were the practical tips and advice that he gives, both for new players, experienced players, new game masters, and experienced game masters. It's a little bit for everybody in this episode, so sit back and enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. As many of you listeners know, I recently came back to role-playing games because of the lockdown. As I prepared to clear the dust off my Game Master skills, I came across a YouTube channel called Runeslinger, and it's created by Anthony Boyd. Now, Anthony's been gaming since the early 80s. 10 years ago, he started a blog and YouTube channel devoted to role-playing with a focus on becoming a better player and a better GM. Now, he has worked as a writer, designer, and or editor for several different companies, including The Design Mechanism, and he's currently the lead editor for the Ubiquity system from Triple Ace Games. So, Anthony, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thanks for having me. It's a long walk up the stairs to get here.
Well, and for those listening, I'm based off of the East Coast in North Carolina, but Anthony, you're in Korea, correct?
That's right.
So how did you end up in Korea?
Well, it was one of those things. It's a common story over here. I decided to, refocus my energies and take a year away from everything and just come to Korea for a year and see what that's like.
No and, kidding.
That was in 1997, and the year hasn't ended yet.
Well, so I guess, obviously, you loved it there. So what made you decide that it wasn't going to be just a year?
In the back of my mind, the reason why I had chosen Korea was to study a particular martial art, which at that time was only available here. And I discovered it, and I was very lucky to get in with some great people, and I didn't want to finish yet, and then one thing snowballed into another, and I discovered I really liked the attitude of people who live here. It was a very can-do attitude, and where I had come from, there was a lot of, long frustration with joblessness and seasonal work and stuff like that, and there's a lot of people who felt like they couldn't do things. I'd like to go back to university, but I can't. I'd like to do this, but I can't. You know, I hear that conversation a lot, but here I don't hear it. I just see people trying new things and trying to upgrade their skills and move on to something bigger and better. And that was a kind of a nice environment to live in.
I bet. And now, did you know the language before you came over, or have you picked it up since?
Picked it up in bits and pieces here and there over the years. And got married and then we just kept adding piles and piles of dogs. And now the idea of going home is an impossibility.
I bet. So seeing this is not a podcast about Korea, we probably should move on to tabletop gaming. So one of the questions I always ask my guests when it's the first time on the show is, how did you get into tabletop gaming? So how old were you and what was kind of the first thing that made you go, huh, I want to know what's going on here?
Well, we started, one of my friends had a lot of older brothers and they were into, wargaming of various types. And I never gamed with them with, their vast armies of lead miniatures, but they had gotten into basic D&D pretty early. Holmes and Moldvay. And in 1983, the famous Mensur Red Box is released for Basic Dungeons and Dragons, which they bought. And my friend inherited their older copies of all of these different games. And so we didn't know any better. We started playing our own kind of mishmash of Holmes, Moldvay, and then we quickly inherited the Mensur boxes, and on it went, and then, AD&D, and so that's 1983, and I was 13.
Yeah.
And I haven't actually stopped gaming since.
So that's funny because, we some of your story we hear a lot, which is, bigger brother, friend of an older brother handed the game down and stuff like that. But another thing that's common that didn't happen with you is we always hear about a break, or not always, but a lot of times. So usually happens college age. And then and I was one of them. I mean, I played through college, actually. But, after I got my first job, I just didn't seem to have time for gaming. And about a 10-year break from gaming, I was just like, there's more to my life than, work. And stuff like that. And I found gaming again, some 20 odd years ago. That's interesting, though, that you were able to, stay in it and with it for all of that time. Did your interest ever wane at all, or has it been pretty consistent?
It did. Not for gaming. It didn't wane for gaming, but I like to play a lot of games. The first seven, eight years, I was only playing D&D. I lived in a bunch of small towns. There's no gaming stores, anything like that. So I had these inherited D&D books, and I found a secondhand set of AD&D stuff, and this is all I had. I was kind of a purist then, too. It's like, I only need the core books. it's all about creativity. Gary said so. And, it wasn't until I discovered Call of Cthulhu that I started to buy everything. And right. I'd go back and buy older editions of stuff I already had, and it's like, so I can see the development, and I thought I'm gonna be a game designer, and and that was all madness. Eventually, after a decade or so of focusing on things like Shadowrun and the World of Darkness, I felt like I didn't have anything more to contribute to the conversation as the game master. I was feeling tapped out. And what I didn't realize at the time was that I was kind of in conflict with the games I was playing. The World of Darkness was saying, you are a storyteller. You're a creator of tales. And that's not who I am. I'm more of a prompter. And, what if we were here? What would you do if we were here? And then the players start doing stuff because we're there. And then I'm thinking, how does the world react and that kind of stuff? So I was kind of looking for, a game to talk to me differently.
Okay.
And I stumbled across, Hollow Earth Expedition and, by Exile Games, and a game called All for One Régime Diabolique by, Triple Ace Games, using the Ubiquity role-playing system. And it was very familiar mechanics. It wasn't very difficult to learn, but it stopped talking to me about, this is your story. You're an entertainer. You have to write or prepare or craft or any of these things. It's let's play, right?
Cool.
This is Pulp Fiction. It's exciting. Let's get excited. And I was like, this is why I started to play.
Very interesting. Now, obviously a lot of role playing, throughout since 1983. Yeah. Do you ever get into other things, board games, tabletop miniature games, or anything like that? Or is it primarily role playing?
Primarily role playing. And so I guess it's no surprise that I became a big BattleTech player. Because there's something about BattleTech I've found over the years that people identify with the pilot in that mech. Even if you're playing with armies, there's that one mech on the table. Mm-hmm. That's you.
Yeah.
So, BattleTech campaigns, and now the role-playing game is called A Time of War. Lots of crossover, mini gaming there. Starfleet Battles, just because, you really need one quite complex and heavy game in your repertoire, I think.
Sure.
And that's a game I love. And here I don't get to play it. Renegade Legion, that's an old game by FASA that died. But it it's like Star Wars without being Star Wars kind of thing.
Okay. And, okay.
So lots of space combat games and things along those lines, but everything always became a role-playing game.
Got it.
Anyway, so that's really my center of gravity, I think.
Very cool. Guys, I asked Anthony to come on the show because I want to talk to him about role playing. He's got if you already figured this out, a breadth of knowledge about role playing. So I want to get his ideas on what the state of the industry is. And I also, for those of you that play role playing, want to talk to him about how we can get better at it. And for those of you that don't play role playing games, we're going to start off by talking about why you should. So Anthony, the podcast, we cover a lot of things on the podcast, but we probably the vast majority of our fan base is built around Malifaux, which is, a tabletop game, but it also has a role playing game, Through the Breach, that's in the same world. So for those that are listening right now, what can we say about role playing? How has it kept your interest for this long?
When we talk about role playing games, you know, in my circle of players, when we talk about them, one of the long running jokes, I think, is how many decades are we going to have role playing games before the what is a role playing game thing disappears from the front of the textbook?
Yeah.
Like, you don't find that in a tabletop board game. You don't find it in a miniatures war game. What is a miniatures war game? We only find it in role playing games. It's like we're obsessed with not knowing what they are.
That's a good point. I've never thought about that. It is. Like Edge of Empire, like the first 10 pages explain to you what the hell a role-playing game is. That's funny.
Where's the Star Wars?
Yeah, right.
Yes. So I find that I find it really important. We do want to introduce people to the hobby, and it isn't anywhere near as big as tabletop wargaming in any of its forms. I think you're going to find a lot more like X-Wing players than you are going to find Edge of the Empire or Age of Rebellion or Force and Destiny players, probably. So what is it? For me, it's not about story. It's not about acting. It's not about performance. It's not about rolling weird dice. It's the opportunity to make decisions in a situation you may never actually get to experience yourself. So similar to tabletop wargaming, right? You're not the commander of some kind of science fiction, you know, army in space, or, you know, giant BattleTech robots or the USS Enterprise or whatever. But in that moment, you are.
Right.
So let's zoom in even closer. Let's zoom in to the point where you're the boots on the ground, or you're in the captain's chair, and you've got to make some decisions. What are we going to do? Do we accept this contract or not accept this contract? Do we clean out the cave of goblins, or, you know, whatever it is? And that's one thing that the BattleTech role-playing game does really well, is present you with all the Zoom levels. So if you play a time of war, you're the guy or the girl or whatever. And then if you're playing standard BattleTech, the skirmish mode of BattleTech, you've got a lance, you've got four people on your side, you have four people on the other side, and, you know, that's another Zoom level. Or we go out to bigger, you know, battalions and regiments, or we go out to interplanetary invasion, or we go out even farther, you know, the whole galaxy in flames. Where's your desired Zoom level, and what do you want to focus in on? I think that's great.
So I would imagine, Anthony, I would imagine, Anthony, in all the time that you've done this, that you have had many new players play with you before, right?
Yes.
So can you give us an idea, some of the things that, for those that stayed, right? So you introduced them to role-playing, and they became fans and played it for a bit of time, or continued playing it. What are some of the things that they have said to you on why it worked for them and what they liked about it? So they've never played before. You've introduced it to them.
First off, I find that people are groping for what to say about it. They enjoyed it, right? It was exciting, or it was fun, or it was scary. I like to do a lot of horror role-playing games or dramatic role-playing games. So they talk about the experience of the session, the story that we made by playing. And that's cool. And that's the hook, I think. You know, when we started playing when we were 13, it was because, I mean, how often have you screamed at the TV, "Don't go down in the basement"? You know, there were garden shears. Why are you taking, you know?
Right.
So that was the thing. It was that opportunity to be in that moment. I didn't care if it turned into a story at the end. I cared about what I could do in that moment. So that's when I know that we're connecting as a group, when people start talking about, oh, when you went through the window, oh man, that was fantastic. All right. It's not talking about, that emotional beat after we finished the negotiation, when you turned and you wiped that tear away. I thought that was,
Right. Or the, when you rolled all sixes, when you hear people talk about tabletop gamings, they say, I flipped a red joker on the crucial hit. It's funny you say that, because what prompted me to get back into this, role playing was, I have a group of guys that I go camping with twice a year, and it's a camping for gamers thing. We got a whole Facebook to do ta-da with it, right? Anywhere from 5 to 15 guys will show up every year for any of the two sessions. And around the campfire, after we're done playing games and maybe drinking a couple of beers and maybe eating a lot of meat, we just get talking about gaming, right? And one of the things that they kept getting frustrated with is they would ask me, like, what are my favorite games or favorite gaming memories? And as much as I, focus on tabletop gaming, love miniature gaming, my favorite memories, my favorite times gaming have always been role playing. Mm-hmm. And finally, they just said, well, put up or shut up, Craig. It's time for you to run a game. So, so I get what you're saying with that, Anthony, because I, that's what it was for me too. I mean, I had not played role playing games in 15, 20 years. And still, when someone asked me what was my favorite gaming experience, it always was a role-playing session, and exactly as you described it as well. How about for people that are, say, hesitant? So if you had a situation where somebody that you knew, just because you knew them, you're like, you're going to like this, but they were resistant. How have you handled that situation?
I think it's usually some form of, like, in my personal experience, it's been some kind of performance anxiety. What if I make bad decisions, or they've heard something about LARP? They think people are going to show up in costumes or something, so setting expectations has been pretty helpful. Because there's nothing that happens in a role playing session that any adult hasn't done at some point in their life. We've all had to roll dice for something, even if it was just in school. We've all had to imagine something. We've all had the conversation of, like, well, if I'd been there, I would have, and that's it. Now you're a role player. You already know. And
I think that's a great way to put it. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about some things that Anthony can show us that'll make us better role players. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games.
Check them out at CustomMeeple.com. That's with one M. Or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats.
So now that we got kind of an idea, you know, where Anthony comes from and where his love of role playing comes from. And I think you can already get a sense of why I wanted Anthony on the show. I find his perspective and his ability to verbalize certain concepts around role playing to be pretty cool. So I, you know, before the break, I said, you know, we're going to learn how to become a better role player. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that's kind of a terrible way to put it. Because, you know, if I say to you, my guest, when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about being a better Malifaux player, that indicates that we're going to make you better, which means you're going to be winning. One of the things that I have conversations with new players when I introduce them is there is no winning this game. So becoming better, for me at least, Anthony, is about enjoying it more.
Right.
So in your mind, what are some of the things that you like to do to help people enjoy role playing more as on the player side?
There's a discovery process. There's a word I end up using on the YouTube channel a lot is spectrum. And I use it often enough to make myself laugh, which means I have to, you know, cut and start over again. But it's like, wow. Spectrum again, really?
Time for a syllabus.
So we find that I don't like to label. I don't like to say, "Oh, you're this." You know, you're a power gamer. You're a butt kicker. You're a thespian or whatever. There's a famous book, Robin Law's Laws of Good Game Mastering, And it's an interesting read. It's coming from a point of a lot of experience, but it's also putting people in these little boxes. And I find that to be neither true nor static. I might be a power gamer right now in this instant, and then I might want a dramatic scene a little bit later. I haven't found anyone who is consistently any one thing. And the idea of labeling people has always made me uncomfortable, especially when that label is willingly embraced by a player, like, "Oh, I'm a, you know, I read this book and that's me, that's who I am." It's self-limiting, and why do that?
Right.
So you're a gamer, you play games, and let's leave it at that. And so in play, we discover there are moments where you notice that where they are is not here in the room, right? They're not smelling the barbecue from the camp out anymore. They're, you know, whatever, they're on Tatooine and they've got dust in their boots, and it's only going to last for just a split second, but they're gone. They're fully engaged, or some people say they're immersed, but immersed in what? A lot of talk is kind of pushing people toward immersing in their character. You should see what the character's seeing. You should feel what the character's feeling. And we're not all wired to do that. You know, I happen to be, that happens to be one of the focuses that I like, getting really into my character's perspective, because like I mentioned, I get into role-playing games because of making decisions. And that's the most granular point where you can make decisions is in the role of one character. And you can even teach yourself to make decisions like someone else. You can forget about the conversation of what would my character do and just say, I want to do this. But some people get into rolling all those sixes. Some people get into resource management. Some people get into being there with a group of friends and creating something, or just laughing, or telling Monty Python jokes, or whatever it is. There's so many things to be engaged in. And I don't feel it's the game master's responsibility to be in charge of that. I feel like we are a group.
Interesting.
So we could have Bob sitting over there in the corner who keeps interrupting every time we get to a tense scene because he's uncomfortable with whatever the tension is. He's worried about losing his character, so he cracks a joke when we were about to roll the dice. He is worried about losing sanity in Call of Cthulhu, so he breaks the atmosphere of fear. And well, why is that happening? And how can we, as a group, find a place where we're all equally comfortable in the moment? Do we have to just kind of suffer through Bob's interruptions, or can we play in a way where Bob doesn't interrupt anymore? And do we want to? Do we need to ask Bob to step away from this game? We want to play Battletech with you, Bob, but we don't want to play Call of Cthulhu with you, Bob. And Bob needs to contribute understanding to that. You know, like, you're right, I don't like the horror games. I'm ruining the horror games for the rest of you. So, you know, do you want to give up on Bob, or do you want to give up on the game? That's something that the group has to decide, you know. Or you add another game, which was always my solution. So we're going to play Call of Cthulhu on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, Bob, we're going to do our Battletech campaign. And
what have you, so think, if you can think of some of the players that you've had in your games where you really kind of saw that evolution, where they, you know, were relatively maybe new to role playing, or were veterans of role playing, but through time, you know, spent in groups with that you were there, you saw them really reach a new level. And when I say a new level, again, it's that level of enjoyment where they just they fell in love with it. Can you talk us through kind of what you saw happen?
There's two things I guess I would want to talk about in response to that question. One is simply, you know, there's that awkward moment. You've put a new group together. Nobody really knows each other. And you start playing. And because of the game, you become friends. I think we can find that in a lot of different games. First, you start to rely on each other because this is your hobby. And without them, you can't play. Right. So there's that sense of reliance. But then you get to know each other, and you've got stories from the game, but you also have pre-game stories and post-game stories. And then you find that you're going out for coffee after the game. You've been there for 4 or 5 hours playing. You had an hour kind of chit-chat before the game, and now you're sitting, I'm Canadian, so I'm sitting in a Tim Hortons at 2 o'clock in the morning talking about a game that was 6 hours ago. Then you know that the enjoyment is real, because it has opened you up to who these people are, who these people can be. And the game was fun enough that you can just sit and talk about it and not play it. So that's an important thing. But really, in my groups, when we were kids, we always had everybody being the game master. We all had the same books. We all had the same rules, and we were none of us had access to buying modules or adventures or adventure paths or anything like that. So we were all making our own stuff up, and we're playing every day of the week, and everybody was the game. Everybody had their own campaign world. I get to college, and I'm meeting a lot more gamers from different gaming backgrounds, like the RuneQuest guy or the Paranoia guy or whatever. And
that was a good game.
So I was finally exposed to new games, but I was also meeting people who owned games or who played games, but who did not run games.
Right.
And that was really weird to me. So for me, that sign of real, I'm a role-playing gamer, is when they say, hey, I found this game and I'd like you to play it, and I'm going to run it. And so I'm like, yeah.
Hook, that's set.
That's all.
Now, do you think being a game master or trying being a game master makes you a better player?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, in role-playing games, we're making decisions, and making decisions is based on information and perspective and your ability to, you know, to see all the way around whatever the problem, whether it's social or tactical or whatever. So why wouldn't you want to experiment with the different opportunities that game mastering provides? I think the name is off-putting. Dungeon Master, Game Master, the Keeper of Arcane Lore, the Storyteller. All of these things seem to dump so much responsibility on a single person. And then what label do the players get? They're players. What is their job? They play. That sounds awesome. I just want to be a player.
Yeah.
But you still need to know the rules. And you play for a couple of weeks, and you'll probably know the rules as well as the game master. So now you've got zero reason not to be.
And do you think that the fear of that burden that's out there, that's what prevents a lot of people from making that transition, or at least giving it a shot?
What I've heard most coming back to me is, I don't have any stories to tell. I'm not a writer. I'm not creative in that way. And then I respond with, well, did you enjoy my sessions? And they say, yeah, you're a great storyteller. And I said, I didn't tell any stories. And that's a difficult conversation. I've got one video in the Star Wars playlist where we had been playing Edge of the Empire for close to 2 years, if I'm remembering correctly.
Wow.
And the group finally got that I wasn't running them through a series of planned things, that their decisions and the dice and our shared knowledge of Star Wars was what we were experiencing. And it happened because of thermal detonators, actually.
Okay. So now we got to hear that story.
It's a very short story, but in a very early session, third or fourth session, they were trying to find somebody that was important to them, and they were trying to figure out if they could trust a contact who wanted to hire them. And they encountered a bounty hunter because of obligation. All right, so things were very hot, and this bounty hunter was on the tail of more than one of the characters, and for him, it was his lucky day, right? I tilt two birds with one stone.
Sure.
And they were dead or alive contracts, so he shows up with a thermal detonator, and they assumed that they had some kind of plot immunity. They thought the thermal detonator, when it exploded, was exciting, and wow, it was really cool that we got out of the way, we got behind cover, and we only took minor damage, and yada, 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 and then close to 2 years later, when they realize that I don't pull punches, that I don't tell stories, that I didn't save them, they're like, you used a thermal detonator on us. It's like, oh yeah, now you get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't save you. You saved yourselves.
Right.
And wow, it helped.
Yeah. Through that process. So now let's talk about it from the other side. What have you found, being some key concepts as far as becoming a better game master, storyteller, whatever we want to call it, as far as running games. And maybe the way to frame it, Anthony, is what were your wow moments where the light bulb went on over your head and it changed how you ran games? What were some of those moments?
There are so many.
you should have a YouTube channel.
Maybe. I think that the primary skills that you need are the same as being a player, but I didn't get to be a player very long. In fact, I played one session, and then my buddy slid the books across the table, said, these are your books. They're yours. You keep them. You know, I've got other copies. You're going to run our next session. And I didn't know any differently, so it didn't bother me. He sat down and he had a map, and he had some creatures, and he had the very tiny, you know, few page rule book. And it's like, yeah, I can do that. And what I hope to communicate is that it doesn't matter how big the rule book is, you know, whether it's a 120 pager or a 400 pager, you can do that. You can just take it and go. But what I learned was that as a player in my first session, I needed to listen to the descriptions because it mattered. That was that type of role playing we were making. If he had described, you know, dripping water, there was a reason why he was just taking the time to describe the dripping water. And so as a game master in my very first session, I had expected him to do certain things, right? Well, he'll have a 10-foot pole, because everybody has a 10-foot pole, apparently. And he'll hang his lantern on the end of the 10-foot pole, and he'll be able to see this thing in the roof. And well, he never put his lantern on the end of his 10-foot pole, and why would he? And you know, I had to listen to what he wanted to do and where he wanted to go. And that was the first big impact. I think more importantly,
on that point, real quick though, yeah, Anthony. Sure. So you're talking a little bit about like a nimbleness, right? That would be that's needed as someone who's running the game itself. So, you know, you're expecting this to happen. You're expecting this direction or this decision to be made. And you've maybe even done a ton of preparation for that line that follows after that. What are some things that you have done to be able to shift gears, to be nimble and to be able to react and have the world react to the decisions the players are making?
What I like to do in my preparation is to think of it as preparation for improv or improvisation, meaning I don't know what the other person is going to say. And I have to start from that point of view. I'm not going to try to predict what the players are going to do. I'm only going to try and predict what my part of the equation is going to be. So obviously there's going to be characters in the background. They're going to be non-player characters. What are they doing before they get interrupted? I don't know what the interruption will be. I don't even know when the interruption will be. So what is a hoped for timeline? If their day goes perfectly, where do they want to be? And do they have the skills to make that happen? And sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have to recruit someone or they're going to have to pay for something. And I start living in that headspace as the non-player characters. What do I want to do? And then we start playing. I know where people are going to be. I've done my prep for improv. I know what things look like. With Star Wars or Star Trek or a lot of IPs, that's really easy. All you had to do for homework was watch the movies or watch the show. So you know what things look like, sound like, smell like. So that just means you need to focus on where people are going and what they're doing and what their shortcomings are, what they have to overcome. And then the players come charging through or bumbling through or precisely moving through in their own particular idiom. And you go, wow, that was exciting. And it's 4 hours later and, you know, when the smoke clears, you think, that was a really cool session. And someone should write that down or someone should record it because that was really cool.
So when you're running games, Anthony, what are some things that you do to make the world real? So we got part of it in when we just talked about, right, is you try to make it inhabited by real people, people that existed before the player characters showed up, exist after the player characters show up, have goals, dreams, and aspirations, just like the characters, you know, that the other players are running. What are some other things that you do to make the world real?
I try to remember different senses. I'm going to say try to remember because game mastering and playing, these are perishable skills, believe it or not. You can have a sense of what you should be doing and then discover an hour into a session that you're not doing it, right? An early one that I find a lot of game masters, an early mistake game masters can make is to tell you how your character feels. And then you get instant pushback, like, I don't feel that way, right?
Yeah.
So there's that going on. So you can find you slip back into old habits. So people who really like dice tend to, in a moment of panic or in a moment of stress, they tend to go to the dice.
Yep.
And maybe that was not the best time to go to the dice. Or we have these long planning sessions. Have you ever been involved in a planning a heist and it's like 2 hours later and it's like, what are we going to do?
Nothing has happened.
So one of the best ways I can make the world feel real is my real world interrupts me all the time. I'm actually surprised we've spoken this long without the doorbell ringing or someone deciding that they need to bark now. But I like to make time a big factor of what I'm talking about. I keep it clear in my own head. I have a sense of a timeline that we're on. Not that the players have to do something on the timeline, but the world is moving.
Right.
And so any role-playing conversation that you and I had together, that's real-world time. And I just keep track of the time. It's been 5 minutes. It's been 10 minutes. It's been 15 minutes. And what does that mean the rest of the world has been able to do in that time? Raymond Chandler, a writer I adore, had some advice that, you know, if nothing is happening, have some guys, you know, kick in the door and start firing. that's a little violent for the way that I play, but
it's very Chandler, though.
but there's the key, right? Something has to happen and nothing will happen without Nothing will happen in the world without the game master prompting it. The players going somewhere prompts the game master to describe and interact. But if the players are stuck, and soon they're going to feel like a bunch of guys in a room talking about what their characters might want to do, but there's this point of hesitation or they're hung up on something. And you're listening to this and you're listening for the point where, okay, the plan is now like circled the drain like three or four times. All you have to do is raise an eyebrow or lean in or say, let's go back to the beginning and let's summarize what's been said or, yep. Yeah, whatever. Or you might say the doorbell rings.
Right, right. Well, and that kind of gets into another aspect of this, Anthony, which is, you know, if you search for, you know, become a better GM on YouTube, you're going to find 100 videos talking about pace, right? And pacing. And I'd like to get a sense from you. Does that mean something to you? And what does that mean? And how much of it is a part of what you do when you run a game?
I do. But I think it's one of those loaded words, kind of like story.
Yeah.
So if I am the type of game master who has prepared, you know, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Dragonlance. I don't know if you played it way back in the day, right?
I'm a couple years older than you, so I'm a Redbox guy and definitely know Dragonlance.
Awesome. Okay. So to be charitable, it's a heavily scripted adventure, let's say.
Right.
So if that's your style, like if you have the ability to create these kinds of richly detailed worlds, if you can inspire people to want to do where your story is going, and so that group is in harmony, so the players don't feel like the game master is writing a story, if that's you, and that's not everybody, right?
Yep.
If that's you, then pacing means something completely different than to what it means to me, right? You're planning your reveals, you're planning your pushes from behind or your lures from the front. You're deciding if is, you know, carrot or stick, and is it okay for someone to die now at this point? You're thinking about the emotional life of the characters. If you game master from the other point of view of just understanding the fictional elements in the world, then pacing is all about the mood in the room right now.
Okay.
So if you're the storyteller GM that I just described, the players are more responsible for controlling their engagement in your story, right? Loving it, liking it, taking you aside and saying, dude, this is so boring. I really need you to change.
You know, yep.
Whatever. Yep. But if you're more improvisational based, then are people faltering, fumbling? Do they understand what you are telling them? So then you need to slow down if they're not getting it, or you need to speed up if they're like, they're anxious for you to finish your description so they can do something, right? So pacing has pretty different meanings. We all end up with story at the end, but was it prepared or was it discovered?
Right. Do you have any structural problems? So with the style of GM of running a game that you're talking about, where it's, you know, prompts, putting the characters in a living world and seeing what story they're going to tell, you know, and compare it to the storyteller version there where you have an arc, right? You have act one, act two, act three. Right. Is that something that you think just happens naturally in the style of role playing that you're talking about, or does that not even matter?
I think it does matter. I think the bugbear that you encounter is consistency. If you're improvising, does everybody remember clearly what happened last week or what mattered to them last week? Does everything come to a crashing halt because some person in the room can't remember an NPC's name or, you know, can't remember that this was a secret? I can't believe you just said that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't say it. That was me. That wasn't my character. It's like, I don't think so. So there are things that happen. So absolutely, this matters. This let's say storyteller versus improvisational as a spectrum, and all the shades in between.
I got you to say it.
Yeah. Everybody take a drink. But the storyteller has to deal with people coming off of the railroad or coming off of the storyline. And they have an easy solution to it. And the pejorative name for it out there is the quantum ogre, right?
That's the first time I've heard that.
Okay. So it's weirdly named. It might be better as like Schrodinger's ogre, but here's the thing. You need them to go left because that's where the story is. And there's just a whole bunch of empty rooms and stuff, or there's nothing important to the right. You need them to go left. So they, of course, go right. And so you just transpose what was on the left to what was on the right. In other words, you take away their decision. They're not telling you where to go. The train is going to the next station regardless. This is pretty much universally reviled when described, and I'm not a fan of it either, but when you're playing in it, if it's done well, you don't even notice. You may realize later, right? You're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, you may realize later.
Son of a bitch.
Exactly. And I've had that experience, and it's not an experience that I put on other people, but there are players who like it. There are game masters who like it. And when they come together, the game is awesome. It's only a problem when you're at loggerheads with what's the right way to run the game.
So what's your issue with it then? So you say it's really not your favorite thing, but it can be done well. Why don't you like it? Why don't you like the saying, you know what? I need this to happen, and I'm going to manipulate the world to get us there so that their decisions ultimately, you know, they think they're making the decisions, but their decisions ultimately didn't matter.
Well, because for me, at the heart, role-playing is making decisions. And so you've taken away the one thing that I was there to do.
Gotcha.
But I've got a friend who loves the story. Like when we were playing, he was writing out the story page after page after page of notes. Like he could have just taken an audio recording, but he wrote it by hand. And the goal was to turn it into a graphic novel. And I don't know if that will ever happen, but the thing for him, the thing that was drawing him was the story. He was he's an actor by disposition and by profession, and it's all about, you know, the plays, the thing. He liked rolling the dice. He liked the tension of that. He liked the interaction socially and whatnot. But he was always focused on what does it mean? What is their motivation? He was seeing the story part of it, something that I'm not doing as the game master. Hmm. So for him, if I had been railroading the whole time, it wouldn't have affected his enjoyment because he was there to deliver lines. He was there to feel the feelings. He was there to play his role.
Right.
When I'm in his seat, I'm there to decide what my role is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to be the smuggler. I want to know what it's like to be in a situation where I might have to smuggle to survive.
Right.
So it's hard to describe. It's different. We can have the same conversation and miss each other. We can pass like ships in the night and think we both had the same conversation. So,
yeah. And it's, you know, part of it is, and which is part of what makes it interesting is it's a free form game, right? It's a game where, I mean, even the amount that rules impact is a variable. I think that the unstructured nature of it, allows for a huge, you ready for Freddy? Huge spectrum of different ways to play it. And none of it's wrong. I'm fascinated right now because I've got three games going, and one of them, only one person has really role played before. The other four, this is literally their first time. It's the Campsite Guys. And it's been very fascinating over 11 sessions now, watching especially those new players figure out what they love about this. Cool. And it's been different for each one of them. And it's also fascinating watching the veteran adjust to it and still find what he wants out of the game. So that's very, very cool. Guys, part of the reason that I first came across Anthony's work was when I started to learn and decide I was going to run the Star Wars system for these camp campsite guys. So, and if you go to his channel, you're going to find what I will argue to be, I think, not only the most comprehensive, but maybe the best collection, of videos about the system itself. So, when we get back from this break, we're going to talk about the Star Wars role-playing game system. And listeners, of course, we talked to Jay Little. I'll make sure to link that in the notes as well. We'll be right back.
Howdy, friends. Here on the third floor, you'll find us playing Malifaux and other games on Mats by Mars. They are scratch-resistant, waterproof, wet-erase marker compatible, and lighter than neoprene. These mats use a new material that almost eliminates any glare. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. Pick a mat size, pick a design, then choose an overlay like the one for Marvel Crisis Protocol or Malifaux 3rd Edition Strats and Schemes. It's going to speed up your deployment and the placement of strategy and objective markers. Until the end of June 2020, you can use the new promo code THIRDFLOOR620 to get a 10% discount on your next order. In the notes, you can ask for the Third Floor Wars logo to be put on your mat for free. Again, use the promo code THIRDFLOOR620, that's THIRDFLOOR620, to get a 10% discount. All the details are in the show notes.
So you guys that have been listening and watching on the podcast, because we have the live plays up on the podcast, know that I have gone headfirst into Fantasy Flight Games' Star Wars system. We've got the Edge of Empire live plays up on the YouTube channel. Soon you'll be getting a podcast with a different group of live plays. And it's, again, how I found Anthony. A big reason why this system really kind of set its hooks in me is that I had been out of role playing for a very, very long time, and a lot had changed. Anthony, you'll appreciate this. I used to run GURPS, like first, second edition GURPS, right? And a lot's changed since, you know, Steve Jackson's GURPS, and things have changed. And when I opened up the Star Wars book for Edge of Empire, kind of blew my mind a little bit, because I had not seen an evolution that led to it. It's part of what we talked to Jay Little about. But let's start with you. So you obviously a fan, because you've spent not only a ton of time playing the game and running the game, but you have, I don't know, what is it, almost 100 videos, I think, devoted to it, if I remember correctly, that, right?
And
yeah. So hours of time of you talking about it. What was it about this system that that you found so interesting?
There's a skill that the game masters develop, that players develop too, except it's hidden to them because they're not, you know, in the position of authority. And that's interpreting a dice roll. There are a lot of games where what you roll, like the actual number you roll, is not terribly significant in and of itself. Like if you need to roll under, 14. You have to roll 14 or less. It doesn't matter if you roll 13. Doesn't matter if you roll 14. Doesn't matter if you roll 2. You were successful, and that's all that really means. But I think if you cast your mind back, it mattered to you that you just made it. Right? So the description starts to change. Like if you roll a 7, you get this kind of bland, yeah, you did it. If you roll a 13 or a 14, it's like, oh, you just made it. You're really crawling over the thing. And you know,
yeah,
everyone's excited about that. So let's actually make that a part of play. Well, how do we do that? And the other thing that I notice about playing is that for a lot of people, introducing the dice or the mechanics is an interruption. Whether that's having to search through the rule book for a rule you've forgotten or access a chart that you haven't memorized yet or haven't learned the pattern for yet, it's an interruption. So what if we take the numbers away?
Yep.
What if we turn it into color and shape recognition for the dice? What if we put a symbol on the dice that you can learn like this? This is a good shape. This is a bad shape. What do the good shapes mean? What do the bad shapes mean? What if we can make it harder for you to actually talk about things that are not game related? What if we talk about, this is a threat symbol, which means in the game there's now more threat. You could just talk about it narratively, right? I'm feeling pretty triumphant about this role. So it takes some steps toward minimizing the interruption. And the pace of the mechanics are such that they're not super fast. It's not like Ubiquity, or it's not like a D100 system where you roll the dice all at once and you know what the situation is, good or bad. So it's a little slower than that. So people have time to think and process, and they look at the pool and they see how things add together or cancel out, and they remember why those dice went into the pool. So, right. And they say, all those dice are now not in the pool. So they got canceled out, which means, and now they're telling a story just by looking at some lumps of plastic on the table. And I think this does a lot for description, which makes games more fun and gets more people involved. It gets everybody leaning in around the table to see what the dice roll was, because you roll in the open, which is another bold and good move. And then finally, it takes the blame away.
Interesting.
So the game master doesn't have to drop the hammer and say, oh, you broke your arm, right? The dice are saying, look, not only is this a bad result, there are two despair showing. I didn't do that. I didn't put in
I didn't roll those dice.
Yes, you did. I'm way over here.
Yeah.
So the dice are showing us the appropriate turns and reversals of a Star Wars, ostensibly, but at least a pulp heroics, right? A space fantasy or space opera, a Flash Gordon, an Indiana Jones kind of narrative experience. And the dice are creating those moments of high excitement and those depths of despair, those moments of triumph, those mixed, ambiguous moments where you're not really sure, is this good for us? Is this bad for us?
Yep.
The dice are doing all of that work for you. So it's like an experienced game master in a can.
Interesting.
Which lets people focus on description, whether they're the game master or whether they're the player. So everyone's there doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's fantastic.
So that was the part. Now, obviously, did you play, or were you at all familiar with the Warhammer role-playing game, which is really kind of the first time that Jay Little kind of introduced this idea, or was the Star Wars game the first time you saw narrative dice?
I had read about it, but it was difficult. I don't know if you've ordered directly from Fantasy Flight Games, but they've gone internationally. I guess not. But it was difficult to get stuff, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to get into Warhammer in a big way. It's a game that I had missed in my different evolution. So lots of people that I gamed with were into one version of Warhammer or another, whether it was the role-playing or whether it was tabletop miniatures. And I think out of a sense of self-preservation and my wallet screaming, I chose not to go through that door.
Sure.
But the more I read about it and the more I heard people love it and also hate it with equal passion, the more curious I became. Like, I really want to read this, but I couldn't get it. And then I got Edge of the Empire, and then I got the dice, and eventually I got the whole I'm kind of a whole hog kind of guy, so I got the whole line for Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition. And
you went back and got the Warhammer stuff.
I went back and got it. I realized looking at the dice that Star Wars is a more streamlined, slightly faster iteration of it. But I wanted to see it. I wanted to play it in its raw state, in its first iteration, because my guess was, and it was confirmed, that it would feel more like Warhammer than like Star Wars.
Hmm. So obviously if you were going to just high level talk to somebody, what makes the Fantasy Flight game different? The dice is the first thing that's brought up.
Sure.
Was there anything else that maybe not got you to get into the game, but really why it kept your interest for so long and prompted you to produce so much content for it?
I found, well, we started to play because Star Trek and Star Wars were the two common points that the group of players that I discovered here. I had moved to a new city, you know, new job kind of thing. So new group of people, what do we all like? We all like Star Wars. And they were really excited about Star Wars. So I said, well, I've got the original Star Wars game, the D6. And, you know, that's always fun. But in my head, I'm going, but I've played it a lot. And there's some things about it that I would love to change. And then there's this new one, which I haven't played yet. So I don't know how it's going to go. And I don't know what you guys are like as players, so I don't know how you're going to react to it. So I've got these two, this war inside my head.
Yeah.
And so I said, I don't feel like arguing with myself. So I said to the group, do you want to play the old one or do you want to play the new one? They said, we want to play the new one. Okay. And the group loved their Star Wars. And that very first session, even though I had the core book out in front of me because I wanted to start playing in a month's time, they wanted to start playing now. So we started playing now. I didn't feel ready. So I had the book in front of me. I said, you know, if there's any special, you know, talent that your character has, you are now responsible for knowing what that talent is. Share the cognitive load around the table. I'm going to ask you what kind of damage code your blaster has, because I haven't had a chance to memorize it yet. And,
yep.
You know, we printed out the ship sheets and had the stuff just in the middle of the table. And when someone had a question, we stopped and we became friends by taking all the embarrassment away. More than half the group hadn't ever played any role playing game before. Some of them had never rolled funky dice before. So we bonded over that experience. And so there's a lot of things that kept us playing it for a long time.
Gotcha.
But it was a remarkably successful first game by, you know, in my experience, introducing someone to basic role playing, like the D100 system for Call of Cthulhu or RuneQuest or what have you, had been my previous go-to beginner game. It's a percentage. It's simple. Yep. You roll these dice and you see the percentage. And then the other rules you'll learn as we go on. But this, it looks so complicated. People panic when they see the dice. But what, it's like 5 minutes? Maybe? And
yeah,
there are complicated rules in the game. Things like how does burn work? How do guided weapons work? But these are short paragraphs in a clearly written chapter. And yep. If you follow my advice and read the book from the first page to the last page, it will all make sense.
So out of curiosity, after obviously playing other games since then,
yeah.
Right? Is there things that you brought with you from that? Or do you miss the narrative dice? Are there mechanics that you're finding in the other games that replace that for you? Did it change how you play?
It changed some things about how I think about play. The way it was written is you got structured time and you have narrative time. And this highlights the disconnect we were talking about earlier. The game mechanics for many people are an interruption, or the role play for some people is an interruption.
Right.
So let's be clear about that from the beginning. You've got structured play where we're rolling dice and we're going to be talking about numbers, and you've got to internalize those mechanics so that the interruption is minimized for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we've got narrative time where we are making decisions and we are trying to understand who our characters are. So you've got to know what that is. You've got to know where you are so that you are present in the moment. So I think that's great. This is it doesn't come out and say that they're teaching you this concept, but you learn it anyway. And I found it's the ultimate bridge game. You're an old OSR guy. You're really interested in the old games. You want to keep playing some version of Basic or D&D Cyclopedia or Metamorphosis Alpha or something, but you love Star Wars and you'd like to try this out. The game has open arms. It will welcome you in. There's stuff in here that you understand and will guide you to the new stuff. And if you started with some lesser known game that uses more experimental mechanics, well, the game has pretty experimental mechanics. So
Sure.
Come on in. And hey, look, there's this other more structured way to play that you're going to learn. And maybe that will be your window into older games, which are still pretty cool.
That's cool. So, guys, we're going to take one more break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about the games that Anthony is playing now. These are two games that I'm not familiar with, so I'm really anxious to learn about them. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Alexander Zdanchuk from Riga, Latvia, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars. Those guys open the beauty of Malifaux 3rd Edition to me and continue to provide tons of great content. You can support them too. Follow the links in the show notes below or search for Third Floor Wars at patreon.com.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Hey, need to give a special shout out to some of our recent patrons: Joe Hadfield, William Marjoram, Benjamin Chia, Alan Connell, Sean Fisher, James Whitbread, Bob Suderman, Nick Cromarty, Blair Thompson, Sean Ratner, Christopher Rue, and Cody Ravicki. Because of you and the 100 other plus patrons, we're able to put out all of this content. Thank you.
So when Anthony and I first connected, and he made the mistake of saying yes, he'd come on the show. One of the questions I asked him was, you know, what are you playing now? Because I noticed that, you know, the Fantasy Flight videos were older. And he talked about two games, and they're two games that I'm not familiar with, which doesn't mean much because I am relatively new to get back into role playing games. And the first one I want to learn about, Anthony, that you mentioned was Slay, and it's S-L-A. Mm-hmm. My understanding is you pronounce it Slay. Can you give us an idea of, first of all, what it is and why do you like, why are you playing it or what brought you in?
Well, I think, gamers who were around for the original World of Darkness may have been exposed to Slay Industries as a role-playing game, but it's one of those games that people bought maybe and didn't play in as large a number. I think a lot of people did play it. It moved around a lot through different distributors and publishers. So it was successful. And why play it? It's a very dark dystopian game. And you are in a position of playing operatives for a giant mega corporation, and we're far, far in the future, and these megacorps aren't fighting over cities or territories like they would in a Shadowrun. They're fighting over planets. And so there are alien species and futuristic weapons, but what draws me to it still is its power dynamics and its politics. So unlike most games out there, you're not playing for experience points per se. Your characters start out quite capable. They'll slowly become more capable. But what you're really playing for is your rank and position, your status within the company. So you get
interesting.
You're doing the crap jobs, kind of like the rat catcher in Warhammer. You know, you're doing crap jobs at the beginning, trying to claw your way up to getting more lucrative jobs. But the jobs that you're doing expose the rotted white underbelly of the society that you live in. And are you playing the characters that don't care? And what does that say? And are you playing the characters that do care, but continue on that course of action anyway? And what does that say? And
yeah,
do you feel compelled, even in your fictional headspace, to rise up against this adjustment, injustice? Well, what does that say?
And that's interesting. So it sounds like the setting was something that hooked you. Was there anything mechanically that you found interesting about the game?
Yeah. So much. I mean, it was quite hard to get into. I had the very first edition, which needed some tweaks in a revised edition, but like a 1.5 edition. But once I got that, it all fell into place. One of the coolest things I want to share about it is that it does away with rolled initiative.
Mm.
So your character's attributes matter, and they matter all the time. So how tough you are, how much damage resistance the character has, how fast they are, all of these things come into play. So depending on your traits, characters and their opposition are sorted into action phases. One round has five phases, and you could act in some or all of them in the same order, which means players find it a lot easier to start organizing tactics as a group. They start thinking of themselves as, I'm the guy who goes first. The right. two of us then have a coordinated action, and then I act independently again, and then we have another coordinated action, and then my partner acts and I don't, and you know, this kind of thing.
Yep.
It's very rich decision-making. Removing the randomness comes from, when are the opponents acting? So it's just a different way to play. Yeah. It was refreshing. And armor mattered. And so as the incoming fire is coming in, the value of your armor is decreasing, so you need to make different decisions. Healing cool. is awful, so you don't want to get injured.
Right, right.
So all of these things I love.
Oh, that's cool. Now, how about Ubiquity? Because I think that that's the one that you really are knee-deep in now, right?
Ubiquity, I mentioned earlier in the podcast that I was needing to play differently, and that there was a game that reminded me what I loved about gaming. So this was Ubiquity. And Ubiquity is a system. It appeared in a game called Hollow Earth Expedition by Exile Games, which is exactly what it says on the tin. You are trapped inside the Hollow Earth. I mean, think the old Warlord comics, or think an Indiana Jones kind of feel, or what have you. And there you are, you're trapped inside and you need to get out. That's how you could play the game. Or you could play it in the 1930s on the surface and you're looking for the way in, or
interesting,
or what have you. This line has expanded to include Mars. So if you were in Robert E. Howard, you know, Martian Chronicles kind of, or Edgar Rice Burroughs mood,
yep.
you could do that. I mean, it's kind of cool. And it's meant, the system is very fast. And the system is designed to give you, let's say, an archetypal character. There are no character classes or things like that. You're building characters by spending points and choosing what you like. But it's talking to you in a sense of who this person is. Are you playing Indiana Jones? Are you playing Indiana Jones' dad? Have you decided to play Marcus for some reason? Getting lost in your own library? You know, it's all of these characters are viable and can work together. And for the person who likes to spend points efficiently,
yeah,
you can do that and create a very directed, maybe one trick pony in some people's perspective, character that can be successful, that isn't all weaknesses with one power move. Or you can do the opposite. You can try and make a broader character that you want to build into a character who has developed over time because of what happened in play. So it's nice and flexible. There's no meta plot. There's no game designer or writer telling you what's going to happen next in the world. So I like that. But the game that hooked me on Ubiquity was called All for One Régime Diabolique. And this is a Musketeers game. So 17th century France. And everything supernatural that those people would have believed were real, you know, werewolves, demons, vampires, they are.
Right.
And you are the king's musketeers. You're protecting him against threats. And, well, at night, the threats are horrifying.
Interesting. So it kind of has a bit of a fantasy element to it, but also has the horror, which we have found out you like.
So that combination is just, it was just my sweet spot. And that's the game, that's my go-to game. But Ubiquity has a lot of different games. Older gamers will recognize Space 1889.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
It's been revised. The original writer was involved in the project. The game line is now essentially complete. It was put out by a company called Clockwork. So that's pretty exciting. There is a fantasy setting called Desolation. High fantasy, really powerful magic, but it's after the world has ended. And okay. You are the survivors in the ruins. Like, good luck with that.
Interesting.
The one that we're playing these days is called Leagues of Adventure. It's also by Triple Ace Games. And it's set in the 1890s. So it's got kind of an era or an atmosphere of invention and exploration. The world is still... Various pockets around the world don't really know who each other are in any real sense.
Sure.
And so it's got weird science types of invention like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or the Time Machine and this kind of thing. And it has expanded into Leagues of Gothic Horror and Leagues of Cthulhu. So there's different campaigns. It's kind of like Edge of the Empire, Age of Rebellion, and Fantasy Flight games.
Yeah.
If you want a different flavor of the game, it's all there for you.
And are the mechanics universal? Is it kind of like my old GURPS game was, where you're still mechanically playing the same game, you're just changing the setting?
You're changing the setting, and then there are certain mechanical tweaks. So Ubiquity came with some built in. So if you want a really high action, like an Indiana Jones movie where Indy gets hurt, you can see him getting hurt, but he can somehow manage to keep going. You can turn the dials up on the game system so that your characters are more effective. Or you can go the other way and turn them way down, like a Lost City of Z kind of thing. And so they are very, very realistic. I shudder to say. So more fragile.
right.
So that's kind of cool. And so the horror games add in horror elements for stress and strain and that kind of stuff.
So having, again, going back to where we started, we've got... more than a few years, you have been playing and watching it. Where do you see kind of role-playing games are now? I've heard some people say that this is the best time ever historically for role-playing. I've heard people call it the golden age right now of role-playing games. Where do you think we are? Do you think that really, both mechanically, as far as acceptance, as far as the number of people that are interested in playing it? Can you give us a sense of where you think we are in the timeline history?
Well, when we were kids, I felt it was harder to find people to play with. Either you introduced someone who'd never heard of it before, or they'd seen like the TSR ads in a comic book or something. You're always introducing it to people. I have more people coming to me now saying, I've always wanted to play, but I didn't know anybody. I find people are more proactive about it. I guess the biggest change is our interconnectivity. I mean, you can now go online through video chat. It doesn't have to be video chat. It can just be audio chat. But you can connect with anybody in the world as long as your schedules sync up. So that game you've always wanted to play, there's now like zero reason why you can't.
And there's hundreds of people that are playing it.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised. You might want to do it through a virtual tabletop, or you might just want to connect directly through some kind of chat program that you're comfortable with, but you can't. You just have to let it be known that you've got that game and you want to play that game. And there are lots of role-playing game communities, and some of them are super friendly and some of them are just social groups where no one's actually playing, and some of them are all about the play. So I don't know. I think labeling something a golden age, that's for the future to decide.
Right.
But we're seeing it mentioned on TV. We are seeing it not mentioned on TV as an odd thing. We're seeing it as something that the characters are just doing in the background, because that's what people did. Mm-hmm. Like in the Stranger Things kind of vibe. And that's great for bringing people in. Role-playing games have permeated culture through video games. I would think of that as computer role-playing games, but you know, it's not an unheard of concept. So you want to really play a role playing game? Here's one where you can literally do anything, right? That's right. The only hook you need. And so it's a great time to be a gamer. We're still arguing about stuff. We're still very tribal. I don't know why we can't get away from.
We can't. We can't.
Why can't I just let you like your game?
Oh, boy. Don't you? I'll tell you. You're going to trigger me, man. That gets me started on stuff. I'll tell you. I'm going to quickly move us on. I would be curious because something that, again, is new to me. It may have been around for a long time. But, you know, as I was easing back into this hobby again, I was amazed at the amount of live play broadcasts are out there, both, you know, just people like you and me doing it, and, you know, actual celebrity ones, you know, that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people watching it at any point in time. I'd like to know kind of what you think about that as far as, you know, that being present. Do you think there's anything about it that helps, anything that hurts?
I'm so glad. I mean, the play is the thing, right? I mean, I'm one of those guys who has the big shelf of games, right? And people say, you can't possibly play all of those. Like, you know, you're just a collector. But I have played most of them. You know, just the ones that I've purchased in the last year haven't really ever hit the table.
Right.
So, I mean, I buy games to play them. And an unplayed game is a sad game.
I agree.
So now with actual play, those barriers you were talking about before, people who are hesitant, you can point them at actual play of whatever type of game, at least. If you can't find your exact game, you can find a type of game that people are playing. And maybe it's being played really well, or maybe it's being played in a very casual style, or, you know, maybe the audio is bad and the video is bad, but they can see proof that people actually sit down and do this, and they can see that look in their eyes at some point during play where their enjoyment is maximized. They're having a great time. You go, look, this is what I want to do, and this is how I want to do it. And, or I want to do this, but not that. Makes it really easy. So that's awesome. Actual play as a learning tool is incredibly valuable. As a downside, people already find reasons not to do things. They get in their own way. Oh, I could never do that. And then you show them someone who's a professional voice actor or who's a public speaker who doesn't mind being on a stage in front of 1,000 people or whatever. And they, oh, I could never do that. And then they make it true. And I find that that sad. So it's our duty maybe to help them realize that they can, that they do it every day, that, you know, there isn't a moment that goes by where we're not imagining some other outcome. Some guy cuts you off on the highway. And he's like, oh, you know, you're imagining that didn't happen.
I've role played that one a few times.
So, you know, don't let people be intimidated by what they see in an actual play and use it to make your game better. I think is awesome. Record your own sessions and listen to yourself. How many times do you go, and how nobody cared that you.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I'll tell you, it was, I have found it very helpful for my group. You know, obviously we're putting it up on the channel for people to consume, but I think I would do it anyway, even if we never published it, because it has been, I think, very valuable for them as players to go back and watch what they made. And it's been very interesting for me. There's been a few times where, you know, I'll be editing the episode, the session, and go, oh, wait, I need to write this down. You know, this is something that I kind of like glossed over, but, you know, now we're three sessions later and this is going to come bite them in the ass. So, it's definitely very, very interesting. Well, Anthony, I really appreciate you taking the time, my friend. Like I said at the very beginning, a huge fan of what you're doing for the game itself. Is there any shout outs or plugs that you'd like to get out there?
Well, we've talked about some of my favorites already. I mean, you know, Triple A's games, if you're into that kind of play, that pulp heroic play style, then you're going to find a lot of very cool things for Savage Worlds or for Ubiquity at Triple A's games. So that's great. And if you're an older gamer like us, then definitely check out the products by The Design Mechanism. They do a game called Mithras, which is a D100 based game. So this is a long lineage. This is, you know, one of the oldest games or one of the oldest lineages for system out there. They've just released a Leoness role-playing game based on the writings of Jack Vance. Wow. And it really feels like the books. And cool. That's quite an accomplishment. So, yeah, there's so much cool stuff out there. Anyway, play games.
All right. Well, guys, I'll have links to all of that in the show notes. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, thanks for listening.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Faux Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. Faux Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the U.S. and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
All right, this next one's going to be all you. I'm actually pretty excited about this because I have read a little bit about it, but I didn't want to read too much about it because I think it'll be better if I learn at the same time as the audience.
Cool.
Which one do you want to talk about first, Slay or Ubiquity?
Ubiquity. Let's talk about Slay because I'm likely to have less to say about it, and that means we'll get to Ubiquity. If we start me off on Ubiquity, Perfect. We'll go forever.
All right, I'll bring us back. Right. So you see, I dropped the break because we had a rhythm going. So people have to listen to two ads in a row now.
They'll like it.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, I used to be, when I first started this podcast, I would be super rigid, you know, about the structure that I put together. And I luckily have gotten over that because I think it's better for the listeners instead of just to kind of see where things go.
It feels more live.
Yeah. So what do you want? What do you think would be important for this next segment?
About Fantasy Flight Games Star Wars?
Yeah.
I think we have to talk about the dice.
Yep.
And did you run the printed adventures?
So that's what I've been doing with this group. And that's been a combination. I am definitely more a let's just create a world together type GM, but I haven't done this in a long time. Sure. And I actually found the printed stuff, even just out of the beginner game, and the Game Master games were pretty good.
Yeah.
And weren't as railroady as I remember things being. So, but I'm looking forward with this group and another group that I'm working with to kind of get to that point. But because so many of them are new to it, they haven't been. So that's what we'll do. Let's start off talking about the dice and what made this system different and what made the system interesting to you. Because obviously you spent a lot of time not only playing it, but also producing stuff on that. And I'll just kind of pick your brain a little bit.
Sure.
Does that sound all right?
Sounds great.
Great. Got it. So what I'm hoping to do with this next segment, Anthony, is kind of pick some of the stuff. Obviously, we're not going to do all your videos, right? But what I hope to learn is some things that you have taught in your videos, or that you've taught friends as you've been playing, that really can up people's enjoyments as players.
Cool.
And talk about what that means. And we look at that pretty pup.
Yeah.
And kind of what that means. One of the things I'll say as we introduce the segment is, I'll say we're talking about becoming a better player, and I'll talk about, that doesn't mean like a better tabletop player, because that indicates a winning and a losing, and I'll do that part of the intro. But I kind of just want to leave it open for you.
Okay.
And I'm sure we'll end up talking about a million things. So, all right, I'll bring us back.
All right.